Welcome to the Raging Rhino Podcast. This is podcast number 119. My name is John. I've got time to think about the beauty of a thousand variations. It was 1985. I had been into comic books for almost half my life. 6 years. From the time in mid-1979 when I picked up my first comic book, Flash 275, I had absorbed as much of the mainstream DC universe as I could. Flash led to Green Lantern and Firestorm, my three early favorites. Most importantly, I found the Justice League of America. I would go to the flea market near my house, where Ben Dunn ran a small comic book store. I grabbed as many back issues as I could find, and then I learned of the Justice Society, and the original Flash, the original Green Lantern, even found out the original Batman had died. All those original heroes from the 30s and 40s, who are now much older, were from an alternate universe called Earth 2. That led to finding stories about Earth 3 and the Justice League's evil doppelgangers in the Crime Syndicate, the Freedom Fighters of Earth X, and fantastic stories about defeating incredible foes. Because DC was more than just their main continuity. There was a multiverse. All these Earths occupied the same space, but vibrated at different frequencies that kept them separated. Barry Allen was the first to cross over to Jay Garrick's world as the Flashes met. From there, anytime a story couldn't fit into the main DC continuity, it became an alternate Earth. You also got strange twists on history. What would happen if Germany had won World War II or England had won the Revolutionary War? Even within the concept of superheroes, you got to play with different ideas. How would Superman's secret identity progress as he got older? While the main Superman was still hiding his secret from Lois Lane, the older Earth 2 Superman married her and took over for Perry White as editor of the Daily Star. No, it was Star first, then Planet. Then a buzz began about the brief appearances of a shadowy figure known as the Monitor, who, over the course of a couple of years, showed up for a few panels in almost every comic DC was making at the time. He observed the various heroes and sold weapons to villains, later found to be a tactic used to test the heroes to find the ones he needs. Then, a couple of foreboding house ads, one with the Monitor's shadow, popped up in the comics for an upcoming limited series called DC Universe, Crisis on Infinite Earths. Worlds will live, worlds will die, one ad read, while the other proclaimed the DC Universe will never be the same. Wow, that sounds big, doesn't it? As the event drew closer, those two lines were combined together above an image of the first issue's wraparound cover. The bottom of the ad showed they had dropped the DC Universe part and the subtitle Crisis on Infinite Earths became the official title. That first issue's cover showing a mix of characters from across the multiverse seemingly floating in space and screaming in terror as multiple Earths are being blown apart in the distance. That'll get your attention. The best part for me? The series was drawn by George Perez, then and now, my all-time favorite comic book artist. This promised to be a story on an unprecedented scale. And it delivered. So, how about some spoilers for a 35-year-old comic book series and the recently completed CW Arrowverse crossover of the same name? Many of the story beats remain the same in the television series. The mysterious Monitor collects heroes from across the multiverse that he believes can defeat his evil antimatter universe counterpart. The heroes have to protect towers designed to prevent the worlds from being destroyed by antimatter, but they're overwhelmed by the anti-Monitor's shadow demons. Harbinger is controlled by the evil twin and kills the Monitor. An attempt to go to the past to prevent the Monitor from setting off the chain of events fails. So the Spectre meets the heroes at the dawn of time and defeat the bad guy. The heroes wake up on a new Earth that's a merger of others, and only the ones who were at the dawn of time remember what used to be. The Anti-Monitor makes one last attempt to destroy this new Earth Prime, but is defeated once and for all. There were a lot of things that were important about that original comic book series. Nearly every hero and villain ever created by the company made it into that series. I read somewhere that was around 500 characters. One character glaringly missing from the entire series? Green Lantern Hal Jordan. At that point in the continuity, he had quit being Green Lantern, so he was off the board. Now that hurt a little bit because he was my favorite character. I mean, other than Hal Jordan, the only other character I can think of that didn't make it in is Brother Power. Don't ask. Issue number 7 is one of the seminal comic book covers of all time. Superman holding the dead body of Supergirl as dozens of heroes stand in mourning behind him is striking. That issue, of course, shows Supergirl sacrificing herself to save a wounded Superman and made it clear to readers that anything could happen. The next issue, number 8, featured the death of Barry Allen, destroying the antimatter cannon and saving billions of lives. I mean, if you're talking about characters that have also appeared in the CW shows in the Arrowverse, the original Green Arrow, Lex Luthor, and Huntress are also killed off during the comic book series. The original Robin was killed. A character Marv Wolfman and George Perez created in the Teen Titans not long before they started working on Crisis, named Cole, was killed off. And that's the way they intended it from the beginning without telling anybody. Wonder Woman died quite unceremoniously in the last battle with the Anti-Monitor. In fact, it was even the last shot he gets off before he meets his own end. Well, for a few decades at least. These are comic books we're talking about. Basically, any character that was a counterpart to another was either killed or disappeared from existence. By the way, the discussion in the show about them throwing the Anti-Monitor into the sun that sets off a solar system destroying wave, that's how the original Superman finally defeated the Anti-Monitor in the antimatter universe in the comic book series. I mean, come on. The very first and arguably greatest superhero in DC Comics history is the one to finally end the biggest threat in their history? How perfect is that? This was the comic book game changer. This was daring. This was the original reboot. And deep down inside, I was really disappointed they did it. I understood how it could be confusing for some people. Multiple Earths, multiple timelines. Sure, you had completely different Green Lanterns. Alan Scott carved his ring from a mystical meteorite, while Hal Jordan's ring was a super science creation of an advanced alien race. There were completely different Flashes. Jay Garrick got his speed from inhaling hard water fumes. Don't try to think too hard about that one. While Barry Allen got his speed from a lightning-charged chemical spill. But up to that point, every Superman was a Kryptonian disguised as mild-mannered newspaper reporter Clark Kent. And every Batman was wealthy playboy Bruce Wayne. Only costume differences could help you tell which Wonder Woman you were looking at. There was a lot of concern that new readers would have trouble grasping the concept of multiple versions of the same character. And maybe that was true for some new readers, or even most new readers. But it wasn't true for me. I got it right away. I loved the multiverse. I loved the annual meetings between the Justice League and the Justice Society that always turned into a battle against one or more villains. I loved the idea that an evil version of the Justice League ruled over another Earth. I loved that characters like Red Tornado crossed over from one Earth to another for a fresh start. I loved that on Earth 1, the heroes encouraged their sidekicks to fraternize and eventually start the Teen Titans, while the heroes of Earth 2 refused to let their own superhero children join the Justice Society, so they formed their own team, Infinity Incorporated. I loved the multiverse and all the craziness that could happen. I loved seeing the different takes on characters, and I was sad that it was coming to an end. Even if they were going all out with an epic story to restart the DC universe from scratch. Of course, alternate continuity stories called Elseworlds would eventually return. Places where Batman fought Jack the Ripper, or Superman grew up in communist Russia. But those characters would not interact with the main DC universe. Many years later, someone realized that maybe it would be fun to have a way to connect some of these alternate realities, so they came up with Hypertime as a way to do so. Until they finally decided to just bring back the multiverse. I don't know when or why or how it came about, but somebody finally realized that most readers can grasp the parallel dimensions concept. First, DC recognized 52 alternate continuities, including their Earth Prime. Grant Morrison called it the local multiverse, implying that there were others out there. Now, there's also the dark multiverse, where failed universes decay and frightening alternate versions of characters exist. Doomsday Clock took it even further, but that's way too much to try to fit in here. Over the years, DC's live-action and animated TV shows occasionally toyed with the idea as well. Then Arrow and Flash were successful, but when Supergirl debuted on another network, there didn't seem to be a chance that they would cross over, so her show was considered to be on a different Earth. Later, Black Lightning was being filmed in Atlanta, while the other CW shows were in Vancouver. Filming crossovers with that show was logistically difficult, so it was also considered a separate Earth. The CW shows had their own multiverse. The stage was set for something special after last year's Elseworlds crossover, which closed with the Psycho Pirate paraphrasing the old comic book ad. Worlds will live, worlds will die, and the universe will never be the same. I've waited a year since then for the CW crossover event, Crisis on Infinite Earths. For a bunch of shows on a minor television network with a limited budget, this was a phenomenal crossover. It took a chance and did things that a certain other big comic book company hasn't had the guts to do. DC connected everything. The movies and TV shows that came long before the Arrowverse connected. The DC Universe streaming service shows connected. DC properties from other networks connected. The current DC cinematic universe. Oh, hell yeah. Connected. Even animated shows got a nod as the most famous superhero voice actor had a role in the crossover. The Arrowverse tried to connect as many things as they could through cameos across the entire 5-episode series. Some of the moments were well known in advance. We saw them coming. Some of them were rumors that ended up coming true. And one in particular was something that nobody thought would ever happen. 3 times, I grabbed Gina's shoulder while on the edge of my seat during these cameos, which I'll tell you about when I come to them, just as I offer up some thoughts on each episode. Gonna go right into it with Supergirl's episode 1. The first line of the show quotes the first line of the original comic book. Even though people watching should already be familiar with it, the multiverse gets a brief introduction. Like the comic book, the episode opens with the destruction of other Earths, and the first rapid-fire set of cameos, starting with Robert Wool from the Tim Burton Batman movies. All the early guest stars were a great way to kick things off, and they give the first hint of how DC's multiverse is a way to connect the disparate live-action shows. I had heard the rumor Titans characters would be appearing, and it was great to see them there, even if it was a voiceless cameos and there was no way they'd participate in the story. I am disappointed that they didn't incorporate the Earth X heroes from the crossover 2 years ago, especially since the Ray is from Earth 1. The Burt Ward cameo was classic campiness, just like you'd expect. But I still wanted to see the classic comic book Earth 2 Robin costume. It's a bizarre amalgam of Batman and Robin's costumes. Even if it was just like a photo or a display case. I mean, seriously, Google the Earth 2 Robin costume and just feast on the strangeness. I like these shadow demons more than their comic book counterparts. The comic book versions were just solid black silhouettes of the monitor. And I imagine the reason for that was because George Perez already had enough to draw. I'm not surprised the monitor promised to save Flash and Supergirl's lives last year, and then basically told Oliver tough shit when he found out that Barry was expecting to die. I'm also not surprised with how the Flash's death played out, but that'll come up in a couple of episodes. Oliver's early death. That was a big surprise. I was not expecting that to happen in the first episode. And Gina, my wife, was pissed. All she talked about for the rest of the evening was how angry she was that they killed him off, even though everyone knew it was going to happen, and he probably would have more appearances for the rest of the crossover. Pariah's appearance needed a better explanation rather than just exposition. Even just briefly showing him being changed by the Anti-Monitor would have helped. Batwoman's episode 2. It was a brilliant move to hear the voice of Kevin Conroy coming down the stairs before you actually see him. I heard that and thought back to all those years as Batman in various animated series and movies. His exoskeleton is, of course, a nod to the powerful 90s comic book miniseries Kingdom Come. But his comes with a completely different twist of a Batman gone bad. Now, I'm not a fan of Superman Returns. I don't think Brandon Routh, however you pronounce his name, really captured the strength of Superman in the film. Not all of that is his fault. With the exception of a couple of brief action sequences and special effects, the script was really dull and suffered from the Star Wars symptom of rehashing the original movie. Superman Returns was meant to be a sequel to Superman 2, ignoring 3 and 4. So even though he's wearing the Kingdom Come Superman costume, this is still meant to be the Christopher Reeve Superman. And I think combining those two ideas, the classic movie Superman and the seminal comic book story, was a really good idea. However, the better emeritus Superman cameo was Tom Welling reprising his Smallville role. We still never get to see Welling in the costume, as it's revealed he gave up his powers to raise children with Lois. Perfect for the character. But it was still nice to see him punch Lex Luthor one last time. Since we knew well in advance that Kevin Conroy and Tom Welling had roles in the crossover, their appearances did not set me off as much as the ones coming up. But I really liked what they did with the characters. It made me very happy to hear Kevin Smith call John Cryer's take on Lex Luthor the best he's seen in live action. I gotta agree with that. Like Keaton and Ledger before, I really couldn't understand why they would cast him in that role. I mean, John Cryer as Lex Luthor? Are you kidding me? But like the others, I'm glad I gave it a chance. I've stated in this podcast before that Supergirl is easily my least favorite Arrowverse show. And I'm at the point where I will likely drop it altogether now that her part of the crossover has aired. John Cryer was the only thing that kept me going through the last season. His snarky, casually evil take on Lex Luthor is an absolute blast. The Search for the Paragons is a nice twist to focus on the stars of the TV shows and keep an epic feel while staying within budget. Next, The Flash's episode 3. Okay, this episode had the first cameo that I was ecstatic over. There was a rumor he was on the set to film a scene, but the actor claimed it was false. I knew what was going on as soon as they showed the exterior shot of Lux. I was spazzing out, and Gina thought it was from the Watchmen billboard, but I actually missed that because I knew what was about to happen. If you look at my Twitter feed from about a year and a half, 2 years ago, I tweeted how great it would be to see Matt Ryan as John Constantine and Tom Ellis as Lucifer share the screen. I got my wish, and it was glorious. Two utterly pompous, self-confident, and self-righteous characters bantering back and forth, put me in fanboy heaven. Lucifer flirting with both Mia and Diggle, name-dropping Maze, and there was even a quick mention of the alternate pronunciation of Constantine's name. I don't know if this was on purpose, but Alan Moore, who created Constantine, was always pissy that it should be pronounced Constantine. Nice touch by the writers. I do feel bad that they could not bring back the same actor who played Jim Corrigan in the Constantine TV series, but I'm glad the change was at least mentioned. That being said, I would have loved to have seen the other cast members from Constantine. I miss Chaz and Zed. Finally, Black Lightning is brought in. Even though his show is not officially part of the crossover, his episode from that week was a good side story that I highly recommend if you haven't already checked it out. I knew that when the monitor kept saying the Flash had to die, that it wasn't necessarily Earth One Barry. I thought maybe it would be Oliver as Flash, since they did switch lives in last year's crossover. But using John Wesley Shipp's Flash to heroically sacrifice himself, complete with a brief clip from his old show, seemed so perfect. Like Oliver's quick death in the first episode, I was shocked when they eliminated the rest of the Earths, until only the Paragons were safely sent to the vanishing point. I have to admit, I did indeed laugh out loud when Lex took Superman's place, stating, "Oh, I'm so happy that worked." I hated the idea of a long break for the conclusion, but I was thrilled with what had gone on so far. All right. Arrows, Episode 4. This is where Gina got lost and stopped enjoying the crossover. Poor girl didn't have a chance. She needs a This Is Us or a 911 with scenarios grounded in reality. This whole Vanishing Point, Speed Force, Dawn of Time stuff had her sitting on the couch beside me, repeatedly asking me to hit pause and try to explain what was going on. Didn't work very well. Even I was a little confused with why some of the Paragons were lost in the Speed Force until I rewatched the scene. I guess they couldn't get too crazy with the anti-monitor attack that caused them to be scattered. And then came the best cameo ever. I recognized the voice immediately, and I completely yeeked out. Gina, still puzzled over what was going on, didn't quite get it. Suddenly, there he was. Ezra Miller, the Flash of the DC Comics movie universe, face to face with Grant Gustin, the Flash of the DC television universe. Character confusion, costume comparison, realizing that the movie version had never been given the name Flash, name-dropping Cyborg, and then disappearing back into the Speed Force. After the show, I thought to myself, and Marvel, on a movie budget, couldn't even be bothered with showing the Defenders among the hordes stepping out of the portals in Endgame. DC scored big with the fans on that one. That was truly the top moment of the entire series. I thought there was no way they could do better than Lucifer's cameo, and then they did. Plus, it stayed a secret until the episode aired. Word has it that Melissa Benoist, who plays Supergirl, didn't even know about it until she saw it aired on the network. And I don't think I will ever stop talking about how cool that was. Now, again, I realize this is a television budget, but at the end of episode 4, the Paragons were basically just standing, watching, and thinking positive thoughts while Oliver actually fought the Anti-Monitor. All of the Paragons should have been around Oliver at the end. They should have all been around him as he died, not just Barry and Sarah. That part really could have been better. Finally, Legends of Tomorrow, Episode 5. The early part of the episode had the third cameo that caused me to gasp, grab Gina's shoulder, and make a proclamation about how cool this is when Marv Wolfman showed up as the fan asking for autographs. Yeah, I would have been in the stratosphere if George Perez had been with him, but it was still the cherry on top for me. And at least Perez got a shout out later on in the episode. Just like the comic book series, the battle with the Spectre at the dawn of time created Earth Prime and seemingly ended the Anti-Monitor. Also, like the comic books, the heroes who battled at the dawn of time remembered the previous multiverse, but no one else did. And there would be one last threat from the Big Bad. Using Martian Manhunter to bring everybody up to speed was a great idea. Even those who didn't participate at the dawn of time can now be aware of what happened. Also early on in the episode, let me just say, I find Bebo to be corny, goofy, but appropriate for the Legends of Tomorrow and their part of the crossover. My wife thinks it's absolutely stupid. We did notice most of Flash's supporting cast was missing from the episode. If anybody needed a reunion moment in Crisis, it was Barry and Iris, but neither she, Ralph, nor Sisko appear. In fact, Joe and Cecile weren't in the crossover at all. Same goes for Roy Harper and Felicity Smoke from Arrow. Some of the main characters from Legends and Batwoman didn't even get a brief appearance. And I was really hoping for more guest stars from past seasons to show up. It would have been nice to get Kid Flash, Mon-El, or even Hawkgirl to make an appearance to make things a little bit more massive. But I guess when you're full from a meal, you should step away so you don't gorge. One last comparison between the comic book and the TV show. After it ended, there were a lot of questions about how this new Earth worked. I have questions. All these characters that lost their lives prior to the end of episode 3, are they the same or are they near exact duplicates? Case in point, Lila. On Earth Prime, she was never Harbinger. So how can she be the same person as the one prior to Crisis? If you can make the case that she is not the same person, isn't Barry now married to a duplicate of his deceased wife? Earth Prime Superman wasn't a Paragon. Why would he be surprised he has two sons now? Are all the pre-Crisis Earths back? Earth 2 is different. So does that mean Harry Wells and Jesse Quick have been completely erased? Earth 9 came back as it originally was. Why didn't Earth 2? Is Earth X still out there? The Ray is from Earth 1. Does he get a new life on Earth Prime? Black Lightning wasn't a Paragon. Why would his Earth be merged with the rest? What happened to the doppelgangers from the Earths that were merged together? the Batman that Supergirl knew on the old Earth 38 is different from the Batman that Batwoman knew on the old Earth 1. But it looks like the Earth 1 Batman was kept. An early episode of Black Lightning referenced Vixen, who has an Earth 1 counterpart, and Supergirl. Does that mean an alternate Kara died off-screen in the series when Black Lightning's Earth was destroyed? All these questions and more probably never get an answer. But that's okay, because it was one hell of a ride. Way to go, DC. This is the Raging Rhino Podcast. You'll hear from me again.